Welcome to Subject Matter Tabletop,
the podcast about board games and the subject matter that animates them. I'm Steve Gotzler.
And I am Jordan Tynes, and we are here in our hotel room in Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love.
Yes, and we have just spent two very jam-packed days in PAX Unplugged.
Yeah, PAX Unplugged.
It's 2024. Our first trip.
It's our first PAX.
Yeah.
Which we discovered today has only been happening since 2017.
Yeah, it's a fairly new convention.
It's a fairly recent recent tradition for people on the East Coast.
And it's brand new for us, and we are impressed.
Yeah, we're having a great time. I think there's lots of factors, you know, like convention experiences, and like any experience can be shaped by like happenstance and serendipity. But the convention, I think it's been a while since we went to one of these big hobby conventions because we skipped Gen Con last summer, right? So in a sense, it's also just kind of like refreshing to be back in this space with all the industry people and, and speaking to them. But it was also different than Gen Con. It's a little smaller. It's not very small. It's pretty big. But it's a little smaller because everything's a little bit small compared to Gen Con. It's December in Philadelphia, so everybody's got a big coat on.
Yeah.
It's very cold.
But it was so cold that the vendor hall was also a little cold yesterday.
Yeah.
So it was kind of nice to have a coat.
Yeah, it was kind of nice.
And
it's the holiday season.
Yeah.
So
it's
that's
like some
an interesting
weird
wrinkle.
Like holiday theming to things.
Yeah.
which is funny. But I kind of appreciate it. I think that the vibe here has been very good. People seem to have a little more focus. When we go to the big one, Gen Con, it feels like people are spread a little thin.
Yeah, everybody's overwhelmed. Vendors, exhibitors, like everyone.
Everybody's exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
And here it feels like their expectations for how much time and energy you're investing in any one thing are a little lower. So it just feels like you can kind of have a little chiller vibe throughout the whole experience. It's been really nice.
Yeah.
And we've actually, as a result, had some really great conversations with people. It feels
tons
like people are more willing to kind of break off from what they're doing to talk with us for a few minutes. So we thought we would put the mic in front of some folks that we run into and just kind of see what they had to say about their design process. As we're kind of wandering through the vendor hall, we are pausing at basically every booth and kind of surveying the scene and see like what appeals to us in through the lens of subject matter games.
Yeah, that's right. And so we had a couple people that we knew were going to be here that we, you know, reached out to ahead of time. But then we also just spent our time, you know, roving the hall and things would catch our eye and we'd, you know, speak to the people at the booth. If the designer was there, we would, you know, ask them for a moment of their time, discuss the game with them, then share the podcast project with them and ask them if they'd be willing to speak with us on mic. And we got lots of good tape, so to speak, you know, of people talking about their games. And yeah, I think you're right, Jordan. I think generally they were very enthusiastic and sort of like present in a way that like nobody's present at Gen Con, which is hilarious because it is just so massive and so intense. It's also another aspect of this. We were talking to some of the exhibitors about this after our interview concluded. Another aspect is that this is like the end of the circuit. So like it's the end of the year and this is the last big con that these companies do every year. So it is also, I think people are like at the finish line.
Yeah.
Like Gen Con is like halfway through a marathon.
Yeah.
Gen Con is mile 13. And, so people are just in endurance mode, just like trying to get there.
And this is no knock on Gen Con. I mean, it's just a different vibe.
Yeah, it's just a different vibe. Yeah. I mean, people are not unpleasant at Gen Con. It's just, it's so much going on. People are, as you said, stretched so thin.
Yeah. It's harder to pull people aside there. And we did that. So throughout this little catch-up we're doing here, we're going to share some clips that we captured. And we'll try to maybe group things together based on theme of what they said. And, we can just kind of go through our list here. Well, one thing is that we're seeing a lot of zines. A lot of zine-type RPGs.
Yeah, a lot of independent RPG action here. The footprint for that kind of thing is rather big for the size of convention, it seems to me. Or at least maybe it's just buried, you know? Maybe I don't see it at Gen Con because there's so much other stuff in my frame of view. But it was visible here in a way that I loved. It was really cool. I bought this fun one just for personal. It's not very subject matter. It's about, you know, supernatural
vampires.
Horror. But it came with like a solo adventure that's printed, literally printed on a barf bag. So like stuff like that.
Which is really cool.
Yeah.
You know, and I think part of that is Gen Con is like all the big dogs are there.
Yeah.
And so some of the small dogs get kind of pushed out a little bit. And maybe not pushed out per se, like intentionally, but there's just less.
In your attention, like I mean, this is sort of what I was trying to say. Like they very well may be there. Mm-hmm. But it's harder to see them. You miss the trees for the forest, so to speak.
So one of the first things we did is we went down to the vendor hall and found the kind of alley of the smallest booths, which usually means that those are the smaller, newer companies and perhaps more niche subjects to be discovered in the aisles. And we stopped by this one booth that had a bunch of these types of RPGs that are very, very small form, like tiny books. Sometimes
slim books.
Sometimes printed as like, you know, almost zine-like objects. Mm-hmm. And we've been kind of ogling these types of publications throughout our visit here. Mm-hmm. And one of them that stood out to us was about a record store.
Yeah, it's called Save the Music, Damn the Man.
Yeah,
I think, right?
Yeah, so we spoke with someone named Hannah.
Hannah Schaefer, maybe? It might be Hannah Schaefer. We'll find out. If that makes the edit, I got it right.
So we spoke with her, and she had some really interesting things to say about niche design.
Hi, my name is Hannah. I am part of Turtle Bun, a game design two-person cooperative. Right now, I'm talking about our role-playing game, Damn the Man, Save the Music. It is inspired by the movie Empire Records. And if you've ever seen Empire Records, it is a 90s movie about a bunch of punks trying to save their independent record store from being bought out by the man. I think it's a really good example of how role-playing games can go like super, super niche into a specific subject and also kind of take what was maybe like problematic about the 90s and update it to be something that can be relevant to now. So that is one of the things that we love about making indie games is that you can sort of like, you can't really go too narrow because there is a game for everyone.
Which is something on this show, like obviously, we're familiar with, like we've played games like Zhongshu and we've talked a lot about like Coyote and Crow and other things like that.
So it was really great to talk with her and her experiences, you know, coming up with that concept. I bought a copy.
Yeah.
I'm going to try.
I know somebody who's quite fond of the film Empire Records. Yeah. So I might convince them to play it with me. They know who they are.
Then, you know, it's really interesting to hear from a variety of designers. We talked with designers who have different approaches to how they come up with the theme, how they mature their theme as they're designing the project, the game. And one of them is perhaps a more traditional approach to researching the subject, the Obsession.
Yeah, the designer behind Obsession, which I don't know if we may have very well discussed this game on the pod before.
I think we may have mentioned it.
It's been around for a little while now, and I know one of my colleagues at UNC got a couple of copies and brought them into the lab because we've been trying to kind of like lure the Jane Austen scholars into the game lab to do some events around that game. Because the game is essentially like you're managing a Pride and Prejudice era country estate in England.
Yeah. And you have a dilapidated one.
It's a dilapidated one, and you have servants and costs, you know, and like bills and upkeep, and you have to try and throw parties and host eligible bachelors and young ladies and try and make matches and blah, 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 become the center of social life. So it's kind of like Bridgerton, the board game, or, you know, Pride and Prejudice, sort of the board game. We caught up with Stan, and he pulled us aside and told us a little bit about, you know, the sort of behind the music, if anyone remembers VH1, the like behind the board of that game and where it came from.
My name's Dan Halligan with Kayenta Games, and I'm the developer of Obsession. Obsession is a game that I designed initially for my wife. We went to go play Terra Mystica, and she says, I don't want to be giants or swarmlings. She says, let's go watch Downton Abbey. So I got that idea, tried to find something like that, couldn't find it, because I wanted crunch for me and I wanted theme for her. And so what I did is I've always had a love of Victorian literature. I read the literature, I love it to death. Pride and Prejudice and the different dramas and the Victorian dramas. And so I had a little bit of a background on what I wanted to do. So what I did is that I realized that people don't want to play chess with Bobby Fischer. If they see somebody who's an expert at 400 games that's behind them, they're not going to sit down and play, because while I'm trying to figure out how to move my pawn, you've already known the pathway to victory. And so what I wanted to do is insert, following the theme, Victorian fate into the design. In other words, the best player can't always win. In fact, I don't even care if you want to win is your primary objective. I want to knock you off your sweet spot and make you tactically respond to something that comes completely out of left field, because that was the literature of the time. The wife in the attic, the who is Willoughby, things of that nature. And I was able to do that with randomness, and I really believe that randomness represents story, and I believe that pure strategy represents more analytical power. And so with the stories, I was able to give individual stories to every one of my, say, 150 cards, which actually linked to the favors that they would generate when you hosted those events. And that was to keep the theme, to keep the theme. I even make, when you draw a card, you're supposed to show it to everybody and explain how you came to that connection. And that was for the purpose of reinforcing the theme. And I have had more fun losing this game than I've had winning it. When I get a whole hand of cads and scoundrels and gossips, it's great fun because there's a bunch of story there. So I think the magic of thematic games is that you have to lean into, you have to fight against a tendency in the hobby for people to use randomness as a pejorative of a game. When you look at our hobby, they will complain, and they have complained about this. So I actually wrote a little piece on my website that says, don't buy this game until you know what you're actually going to run into. And I document what you're going to run into in a funny story. So that, and I've had people come along and say, I read that, I was in the wrong category, and I said, he wrote that, I'm going to get it anyway. And you know what? I got past it, and I like what I have there for a certain audience. So that's sort of how I played theme as the central piece of Obsession.
Yeah, that was a really interesting booth because it was a whole family.
It was his older sister and I suppose his older brother, right? Because she said he was the youngest. And then, of course, Whirligig, who we also caught up with, is a family affair.
Yeah.
Right? So that's Cole and Drew, who are brothers. But also there's a third Whirly brother, which we didn't know until we met
him. Yeah.
It was interesting to see, like, much smaller sort of independent booths, and that they are in fact these like family affairs. We also spoke to another pair of designers who are a married couple.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was interesting.
Yeah. Who have a very different approach to the development of their theme. They kind of drew more from personal experiences.
Hi, I'm Zara Reed. I'm one of the designers of Kavango Board Game.
Hi, I'm Matt Brown, and I'm the other designer of Kavango Board Game.
And we're married. So this is my husband. And we were in Botswana for the past 3 years in Southern Africa. And when we were there, we got inspired by all of the conservation success stories that we saw day in, day out. I personally worked in conservation, and I was working on the illegal wildlife trade out there. And yeah, we just got so inspired by what people were doing and how they were restoring land to nature. And Matt's always been interested in board games and designing them as a hobby. And we just collaborated together to make Kavango.
We were kind of working on an idea for a wildlife game. And when we moved to Botswana, it just really captured our imagination. We thought this absolutely makes sense. And particularly that idea of transforming an area of unproductive land into a thriving nature reserve just really captured our imagination. And we just thought it's such a cool story, and one that we had just not seen told very often in the media, for example. And we both personally believe, having worked in conservation and sustainability, believe that optimistic, positive narratives really help inspire people much more than negativity. So we really wanted to design a game that brought that positivity to people, and this message that you two, with like some good actions, can do some amazing things.
So the game is based in Southern Africa, and it's inspired by this transboundary region called the Kavango-Zambezi Transfrontier Conservation Area, which we shortened to Kavango for our game. And that's where I was working. It's the largest transboundary conservation area in the world. It spans 5 countries, and it's a historic homeland to some of the most iconic species in the world, like elephants. It's a really important migratory route for zebras and wildebeest. So this area is huge, and it captures loads of different ecosystems as well, and different environments, and a huge array of life. And we wanted to really tell that story. So when we first designed the game, we were thinking maybe we'll have different landscapes across the world and you can play in different ones. And then the more we saw Southern Africa, the more we just thought we have to dive deep and give all of the animals here their time to shine. So we've even got elephant shrews in our game, we've got pangolins, we've got all these different types of antelopes, so all the amazing species and different animals that are on show in Southern Africa are in our game. We've got 160 different species cards, which were all drawn from photos that we took in the field, and Matt did the illustration himself. I think the only one is the pangolin that we didn't see in the wild. Everything about the game, the style, the art, the mechanisms are designed to reflect life and to reflect what people are really doing in terms of conservation in that part of the world, to also reflect the beauty of nature as it is. So we've used quite a simple and realistic style in the gameplay and the design, and we've tried to bring in some nice colors to show the vibrancy of life in that region.
One of the things that from my point of view doing the design, which was really interesting, was trying to categorize all those, that huge variety of species into different categories to make a playable game, and how you build up your ecosystem with those different types of animals. And a lot of umming and ahhing about which category this animal falls into. And it was a really fun process to go through, because we really wanted to include as wide variety as possible. We actually even clarify in the appendix of the game about why we characterize some things as they are, like the marabou stork we classified as a bird of prey, which might be debatable, but we made these classifications based on their position in the food chain, for example, and their size and how realistic they would be as prey species for certain animals, and how you could build up that ecosystem as you were trying to. That was all part of making the game as realistic and as thematic as possible.
It was really nice to kind of look at the pieces, and we're admiring the cards, particularly because they have a huge amount of cards for animals, and they apparently like took photos and then drew the cards based on those photos
on their own personal like safari photos, essentially.
So it was really nice. They're very generous and gave us their time to and their booth was incredibly busy.
They were doing really good business.
And they were part of that sort of like newer game zone. So they were, I think, maybe this is their first foray into this kind of scene, and they seem to be doing a really wonderful job.
I do think, here's another random passing observation, and maybe it's again a false impression, I also felt that this convention was more international. I think that we'll find that when we listen back to this, a lot of the people we spoke with were not from the United States. And I think it's just it's just that much closer to, you know, Europe, Africa, for instance, these places that are in the Eastern Hemisphere. The East Coast is that much closer, and India is that much farther. And so it's interesting.
I don't think you'll hear much of this, but in the recordings that we got, but there's a lot of British accents here. So a lot of British Isles.
People from Europe are coming to this a little bit more, I think,
than Gen Con. The other piece of sort of research that happens, we mentioned that we kind of ran into the Whirlies again. We knew we would. We actually had a wonderful opportunity to sit down with the designer of Molly House, so we're going to be releasing a deep dive.
We did a full feature interview with Joe, and Cole was there as well, because Cole has co-designed some of that game. So yeah, stay tuned for that.
Yeah, well, but that was wonderful to sit down really with them. Lovely. We actually got to play the final version of Molly House finally, and you'll hear more about that. But the really exciting thing too, additionally, was this playtest we did with Drew. We got to sit down and play a brand new version of a game called Hellraisers.
I'm Drew Early, and we're looking at Hellraisers in Kanawha County, which we're going to launch its crowdfunding campaign in March, hopefully, of 2025. This is a game designed by Luke Evison and Matilda Simonson, both designers that made this game for the ConSim Game Jam. So they made it over a weekend and then really liked what they worked on and then continued working on it until we heard about it. And I've had the privilege of working as a developer on this project for over a year with Joe Schmidt, who's done some awesome stuff with GMT too. But this is a game about the labor movement in West Virginia at the start of the 20th century. It's 1 to 3 players, but the core dynamic revolves around two coal companies that are fighting for profits and the labor player that is trying to organize and capture the outrage and create the demands that led to the organization and founding of a union. Play happens in a PAX style, buy, play, take two actions and have bonus actions style, where coal company owners are going to buy cards that place workers on mines, and they might need to buy thugs that protect those workers, these private detectives that were sort of in free reign in these like frontiers of West Virginia where it was close to martial law that had not been really established but was in effect. Now the labor player will have those workers become strikers, collectively trying to shut down mines. A mine that has more strikers on it, more strikers under the card than workers and thugs on the card, is a shutdown site. Coal companies cannot use actions or special abilities on a shutdown mine, so they're going to harass those strikers to get them back to work, and workers might not survive. Strikers might not survive. Dead pieces become outrage for the labor player. And at the end of every labor player's turn, they'll take those outrage cubes and spread them across the market. Cards that are bought from the market that have cubes on them double in outrage and go back to you. And certain cards, like newspaper cards, can convert that outrage into a demand. And when you meet demands, you will achieve closer progress on having your union recognized. But this is a game about a pivotal moment in U.S. history. And this takes place in the events surrounding the Cabin Creek and Paint Creek strikes, 1910 to 1912, which led to the Battle at Blair Mountain, which was the largest armed conflict in United States history since the Civil War, and ever since then. 1 million bullets were fired. And this is a movement led ostensibly by women and children fighting for their families' better living and working conditions. A granny locked her rocking chair to a railroad track to prevent a coal company car from leaving town because things were so bad. When you get paid, not in this prototype that we have in front of us, right, with not finished art, we'll be handling dollars that are script, right? There are dice and cubes that represent workers, strikers, or outrage, depending on their location. Red cubes are going to represent radicals that coal company owners are very annoyed at dealing with, cubes that can't be easily pushed back to work. And then dice that are going to be resolving checks, but also represent the coal that is going to be dug and moved out of mines.
It's really exciting. It's a cool game. It's a really important and sort of interesting historical topic and theme. And the game was already pretty fun.
Yeah, it was really fun. We had a great time. Yes, sure, there's some work that needs to be done on it. But we have a few times at Gen Con played early versions of games.
We did with Drew with Molly House.
Yeah,
that was a trip today to sit down and play with Joe in the convention, the final product version of that game, and remember
after
a year and a half ago, I guess. Yeah, 2 years ago, they sort of like, you know, told us about, announced it when we did the interview with them, mm-hmm. and then a year and a half ago, we played that very early paper prototype, just like the one Drew had of Hellraisers. And like, yeah. You know, Molly House has been such a great success, and you know, congratulations to everybody there on that game. I can't wait to see how Hellraisers turns out.
Yeah, and the cool thing about sitting down to play with Drew is that, you know, that's another part of the research that gets done with games. And, you know, they you'll hear the way that Drew wants to communicate through the game. Mm-hmm. And then as we're playing, we're talking about the, like, how is the message received? Mm-hmm. Right. And that's really amazing to think about how that theme continues to get massaged into every piece of it.
Yeah. And it's really, it was a privilege to like have an opportunity to give some feedback, you know, and like participate in that early prototype stage.
Yeah. The West Virginia, the Mine Wars Museum in Matewan, West Virginia, is actually a pretty new museum, and they we have been in conversation with them sort of once we signed this project, in part because of their collections and their educational resources, but in part because it's a bunch of incredible folks and educators that know this history really, really well, and we want to make sure that this game is being celebrated and championed in West Virginia. And the also hearing even at folks at this show that live like near Kanawha River, that are in the county where the events happened, where they didn't know about this history at this show has been also amazing. But the research that they're doing, really the collections that they have and they are presenting, are directly helping the project, working with West Virginia University and the museums that have scans of the photos that we want to feature and recreate in the game to do both color balancing, but also reprint them. These are not widely circulated photos of really intense, awful living conditions and working conditions. And then some museums that have access to the newspapers, because so much of the game features editorial cartoons of miners drawing, like experiencing their grief and their frustrations through art, where they're drawing the atrocities that are sometimes being published in papers or being picked up by like socialist broadsheets. A professor and someone that works in exhibitions at West Virginia University ran an exhibit on the history of editorial cartoons around the Mine Wars and has been sending us, like, again, PDF scans of newspapers that I've never, ever seen before, of incredible, wild cartoons. Which is great, because, there are scholars that have worked on this particular period from an art history perspective, from a historical perspective, and they have not thought about like interactive, immersive game experiences before. So it's been really fun to work with specifically curation and exhibit managers.
So it was great to talk with Drew and sit down for a few minutes, for actually an hour and a half, and play the game.
It was really great.
You know, it's a game that really boldly tackles a pretty serious subject. Mm-hmm. It doesn't shy away,
which
from,
you know, should be no surprise from the, you know, the company that brought you, John Company.
There's the representation of death in that feels like pretty intense. And so I don't know if that'll change between now and when it gets released, but I felt very troubled, which I think you're supposed to troubled by the way that pieces vanish from the board, and
people get disappeared potentially or die in an accident.
And I think another game that we saw and got to talk with the designer of that doesn't shy away from dealing with heavy political subject matter is Azadi. And so we ran into Zane, who is the designer of that game.
And that's, so remind me, this is like a sequel to Shazen.
Yeah.
Which is another game which you have. I don't know if we've talked about this on the pod before or not. You might want to give listeners just like a super quick overview of Shazen.
Yeah.
It's like a political intrigue game or something like this.
I mean, it's been a while since I played it, but it feels to me like it is a like a simulation of like gerrymandering. You know, you're like dealing with like how districts get
how
votes.
To manufacture an election result basically through other means.
And he produced this other game that's sort of like the inverse of that, and you'll hear him talk about that in just a moment. But he very clearly wants to deal with political subject matter. And what was really cool too is that he had a whole crew with him.
Yeah, he really did. Yeah.
And the filmmaker that was there documenting this whole thing.
They're from India, right? Yeah. So again, this is they had traveled from South Asia, I'm pretty sure.
I actually don't know if he still resides there.
Perhaps they're based in the UK or they're based in Western Europe someplace. But even still, I don't think they're based in the US. That was not the impression I got.
I also got the impression that they were traveling. To be here. But they were having a great time. They were part of the Kickstarter booth.
Yeah, they were featured. There's a big, huge Kickstarter presence. Actually, bigger here than at Gen Con, actually.
It was right in the middle of the room. Couches.
And they had a bunch of like featured projects that they gave some real estate to. And so Azadi was one of those. And they also had a partner with them who was doing another game, whose name I'm forgetting right now, which is based in like South Asian like folklore and mythology and stuff like this. Yeah. It's like more of a fantasy game.
Yeah, and it's like a brawler game.
Yeah, it's a fantasy brawler. But
it
using...
seems like it has a little more depth to it than most brawler games do. But so it was great to talk with him and hear about his process.
Hi, I'm Zain Maimon. I'm the creator of Shasan and Azadi. Azadi is a follow-up prequel to Shasan. In Shasan, you're a politician, you're fighting an election. In Azadi, we flip that on its head. There is no nation for an election to occur. The first stage of the game is nation building, which means you work together and you fight the imperials or you fight the colonizers who are controlling your nation. If all of you work together and manage to steal independence from the jaws of the imperialists, one of you becomes prime minister, or president. So it's cooperative until it's not. And what usually happens in the game is the closer victory is, the more elusive it becomes because people stop cooperating. And that's the entire thesis behind Azadi. What does it take for revolution to occur and how do revolutions succeed or in most cases fail? What got me to make these two games? Well, I am medium agnostic. In the past, I've worked in film, documentaries, writing, and it's always what's the story I want to tell and what's the best capsule for that story. We wanted to tell initially the story of elections and how they work, and we wanted it to be interactive, and we wanted people to talk about policy and not politicians. So we said, okay, let's make a physical board game, because if talking about policy online would help, Twitter would have saved the world, but it hasn't. Once we met Shasan, we understood that a lot of people want to also talk about the fleeting nature of cooperation that happens in election, especially in the growing state of fascism around the world. And that was what triggered us to first study how revolutions occur. We had the privilege of to see revolutions from the outside. Revolutions' friends were participating in. It was very painful for them, but we had the privilege of being on the outside and looking at them, be it Hong Kong, be it Egypt, or all of the Arab Springs, and said, okay, how do we translate that? At the same time, we come from a nation which had its own history of revolution, and our primary market is a nation which had its own history of revolution, so India and the US, but two very different fabrics, two different, very different ways of looking at revolution. One was non-violent, while the other was an armed revolution. So why do these things occur? How does that change the entire ethos or fabric of a nation are the questions we had. And to answer those questions ourselves, we started building a game around it. And hopefully we have done a fairly convincing job of making you feel like that.
So it feels like people here are really invested in the community that gets generated from gathering at events like this.
Yeah.
And also pretty eager to find ways to connect the community outside of gaming. And we stopped by the Mind Clash booth.
Mind Clash Games.
Big fan of at least one of their publications.
Mind Clash Games. They have a game called Septima, which I know you're very fond of, that you have a copy of, which
it's
is
beautiful.
About covens and witchcraft. But not in a kind of like conventional or an expected way. The approach is a little bit more sort of interested in like respecting that as a legitimate form of like community and belonging and identity formation or something like this. I don't know. You're more familiar with the game than I am.
Yeah, I haven't gotten really into it enough to be able to say like what the message is supposed to be. But it was really nice to talk with one of the people at that booth who gave us the impression that company is very eager to engage with actual practicing witches.
Yeah.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dorka. We're standing at the Mindclash Games booth at PAX Unplugged, talking to these lovely gentlemen. We have a variety of games on display here. I'm going to talk briefly about Septima right now. So Septima is our game of witchcraft. In Septima, you play as the head of a coven of witches competing to become the new Septima, who's currently the head witch. She's retiring in a year. It is a card-playing game. You have 7 cards in your hands, and you play 5 each round. You can wander around the forest, gather ingredients, brew potions, heal patients. But if you match before you take the action, that action becomes more powerful. But now it's the two of us going into the forest, gathering little berries, so that becomes suspicious, which triggers the witch hunters who are circling closer and closer each round. They can actually capture your witches and bring them to trial. There's a trial happening at the end of each round. And another action you can take is actually send your loyal citizens, your acolytes, into the trial chamber so they can save the witch. The meeples are drawn randomly from the bag. So if there are more loyal citizens than angry citizens, the witch is saved. And if you have majority, you actually get to keep that witch, welcome him or her into your coven. Your coven has 4 slots for the witches. Each of the witches have a special ability. You can switch them around and nominate your head witch each round and use their ability. So yeah, that is basically Septima.
I was just really excited to see a company express such a strong desire to engage with the community that they're referencing. And that to me signals that they are excited about how their game represents that subject, right? They feel like they've done it responsibly enough to be like, hey, please give this a little more time.
I would love for you to give this to someone who owns and operates like a store for witches.
Yeah, you don't see that a lot in game. Yeah, you know, the other thing too, that actually segues really nicely to a thought I had. It's just, we were talking with a lot of people about how their games communicate serious subject matter in serious ways or maybe fun ways. And fun is just something that we saw a lot of too, right? People are having
people have a good time.
And there are lots of games out there that depict subject matter in fun ways. They're fun subject matter. Like we saw one at AEG. And
Let's Go to Japan.
Let's Go to
Japan.
What
it's called?
Let's
Go to Japan. I think that's what it's called. Let's Go to Japan.
And it's just a game about like designing your trip.
Yeah, you just plan and take a trip to Japan. You can go visit Tokyo or Kyoto. And while you're there, you can stop at a number of different sites and take the trains, and you know, and you score points that are tracked by like little cute like lucky cats.
Yeah, but and the research apparently that went into that is very thorough.
Hello, my name is Josh Wood. I'm a board game designer and a board game developer at AEG. I just designed Let's Go to Japan, which just came out this year. It is a game that I made starting in April of 2020. I was supposed to go to Japan. I had saved up for my trip for about 3 years, and then the pandemic happened and I had to cancel my trip. And so I decided to take all my notes and I made this sort of love letter to Japan based on all the notes, the research I did. I had just started learning Japanese, and so I just kind of was going to learn Japanese just for that trip, but then I decided to keep studying it. I've been studying it for about 4 years now, and it's been a very rewarding thing for me to make this game. I got to talk with a lot of Japanese people, all the artists in Let's Go to Japan. They're all people who live in Japan, so they gave the game a lot of authenticity. It was really nice to get feedback in real time when I was making the game, of people saying, oh, well, you should really include this place, or, you know, it's more natural if you put this kind of location on, and people had their opinions on what people should do or what they shouldn't do. And it was really great to kind of get those extra touches that I think that made the game extra special. In fact, when we were going to think of the Kickstarter edition and what it would include, we thought of a lot of little things that we could add to bring that Japanese experience. And one of the things I was most happy with is that we made the game come wrapped in furoshiki cloth, which is, you know, what Japanese people wrap their gifts in. And I thought it was like, I thought it was going to be impossible for us to do, to be able to have a game come wrapped in a cloth that we made. How are we going to get the factory to tie that knot and everything? And it worked out. And I think it gives the game an extra touch. And so I'm really happy and proud of this game. All the people who did the hard work on this game, the artists, the graphic designer, everyone who helped really do the research with me and make sure that this game has all the authentic touches. Every card has a little sentence or two about each of the places, so you can learn about the different spots and actually become knowledgeable about the things that you would like to do if you went, or if you are a person who went, you can go, hey, I remember that place. Oh, I don't know this place. Let me learn about this place. And so it was a very excellent project for me to do, and I'm really happy with how it turned out.
Yeah, so yeah, lots of fun, cool. Lots of great people here. you know, a little more breathing room here.
Yeah, it's just a little less crowded.
Although the air is significantly colder than that it is.
You know, there's interesting trends. It's one of the fun things to do with these conventions is like get this big bird's eye view of like the state of I was going to say state of play, but that's so punny and corny. But like the state of the situation within the industry.
Yeah.
Lots of mushroom games.
Yeah.
So
three or four of them?
I guess we must do a mushroom episode with someone.
We're working on
it. I mean, we have some ideas of some high-profile guests we might be able to hook. But, so that's interesting.
Yeah.
And cool. You know, those games all look kind of interesting in their own ways. Mm-hmm. But there's other things, too. Like, one of the things...
Lots of nature games.
Yeah. And not all of that is the most...
Exciting.
You know, a lot of it is, I think, very painted on. It's sort of like just a very familiar or perhaps novel puzzle of some kind. Mm-hmm. And then to decide what the, you know, sort of like system is going to be made legible with, they use nature. So it's like, oh, it's leaves and water and
rocks.
But there's no like... It seems to me many of these games, I don't want to generalize, right? But there are many games that nowadays, sort of like in a post-Wingspan world, use the nature theme to draw in players because of the success of a game like Wingspan, but they don't really explore the theme very richly or deeply.
And that's fine, too. I mean, that's not what we're like. I mean, that's not what we're like prioritizing in this particular episode or ever in this podcast. But, you know, I've played some great games that I had a blast with that are just like very lightly themed.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So it's been a blast. We got like kind of one more half day here tomorrow. So maybe some more things will get thrown into our little catch up. But we thought we'd do it now since we're energized and stoked. It's been a pleasure, Steve.
Hey, it's been an absolute blast, and it was fun checking out a new con and being in a new city with you. We've never been to Philly together before.
Yeah, we saw Benjamin Franklin's grave.
We walked past it several times on our way to the convention center. It's right next door to our hotel. We're staying in the historic district, if anyone's familiar with the city. We're in the Ye Olde, O-L-D-E, city. Yeah. And we're like very close to Independence Hall and the Liberty Bell and stuff like that, which of course we haven't really been taking in because we've been all about board games. But
some good food.
Some great food.
Yeah, maybe some more here in a few minutes, and then we'll probably be back.
Until then,
we'll see you around the table.